Well, thank you very much, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here. I have to say that one of the very first things I was going to say to you is that my talk is going to be really out there. I'm not so sure I want to say that anymore, but I think I'm using it in a somewhat different context, because what I heard this morning was actually, I learned a lot this morning, and clearly there's a lot of movement in this STM market, and actually what I'm going to talk about is something that's perhaps, from my point of view at least, way out there. You can call it left-wing radicalism, you can call it whatever you like, but it's really going certainly beyond what I said earlier, and what was said earlier today. And so you'll take it for what you think it is. So just to sort of build on what Jerry said about my background, to give you, because I get to talk about this stuff a lot now. It's actually a lot of fun, because I go to audiences like this. I don't know anyone. I can say whatever I want. I'm probably never going to see most of you again, because I keep saying that, and then I start running into you. So, you know, but the point is that, you know, I have nothing to lose. This is not what I do for a living, per se. It's what I actually sort of doing for a hobby. But that's starting to change a little. So I have a background in IT, chemistry, and computational biology. So I keep trying things. I'm going to finally figure out what it is I want to do when I grow up. But this is sort of, you know, my current thought. And talking about this stuff is that sort of thought. So we're very data-driven in my laboratory, and I think the Protein Data Bank, which some of you know is just one entity that we deal with, we're dealing, you know, we're throwing out there a quarter of the Public Library of Science, the National Library of Congress every month. So we're distributing a lot of data to people. And so part of my perspective is going to be sort of data-driven, because I think it's an aspect of publishing which is not indistinguished, it's not distinguishable from publishing in my mind. So this is going to be a theme that I'll build on. Yes, I am a supporter of open access, and I didn't just add this phrase in there when Jerry was talking about it. I do too believe that there has to be a business model. And I think we already heard this morning that there are evidence of, you know, a number of business models emerging. And, you know, but it takes time, and I think that has to be there. I'm involved with a company that is actually called SciV.tv, which I'll tell you a little about. So I do appreciate these sorts of things firsthand. I also appreciate that I think in some ways PLOS has been very successful, but it's taken like 7 years to get to a point of actually financially breaking even or thereabouts. So, you know, there's lots of things to consider here. And I'm becoming increasingly interested in scholarly communication as I get older. It's just something about the idea of making the most of what we actually produce as scientists that drives me to come and talk at meetings like this. So that's kind of my background. And I acknowledge that, you know, every group is different. And what I'm telling you is really coming from my experiences in the biosciences, which is very different than being in humanities or in the social sciences or somewhere else. So, you know, please accept that from that point of view. But that's most of your backgrounds anyway. So I'm interested to see what kind of reaction I get to my viewpoint at the end of this. So either you will be amazed, or you'll be fearful, or you'll be amazed and fearful, or perhaps you'll just laugh and think I'm completely off the wall. But as I say, what have I got to lose? So let me start then by actually providing, and probably the first half of this presentation is really about the motivators, the drivers for change. Change that comes, that you're experiencing, and also that I'm experiencing, that you may not be so familiar with, and that's obviously where I should put my emphasis, because that's the role of this session. So what's wrong with me? Okay, well, you're probably already thinking that. You've got plenty, you can probably see plenty in that already. Well, what I really mean is my laboratory. Well, here's one of the major problems with my laboratory right now. We're in this massively growing and very vibrant science, and there is just no way that we can begin to read anything like all of the research articles that you're publishing, even in our own little area. I mean, PubMed's now, some may know the numbers better than I, but it's of the order of about 1.2 million papers per year are being indexed by PubMed. That means since I've started, probably 50 papers have been indexed. Now, it's a scary thought. I have a student who comes in to me with the very first paper they've published. They're so excited. You know, this is, or they're going to hope to publish. And they're all excited about it. And the thought that always goes through the back of my head is, in the few minutes we're talking about this paper, you know, 50 other papers are going to be published. So, you know, the intrinsic value of an individual publication, you could say, is potentially coming into question. You know, obviously a lot of authors don't want to think that way, but and I think we're also being driven to much more incremental publication. And I think that's a fault of the system, and we can talk more about that, because I really want to talk to you, not at you, so I'm hoping we'll have a dialogue about these things. So I'm just really raising these points. So this is the kind of stuff that's constantly on my desk that I'm trying to wind my way through. Well, of course, if we've actually got way more to read, it means we can't keep up. So what we're doing is we're essentially reading less than we did before, and we're scanning. You know, I'm now scanning papers in ways in years past I would have read avidly. I just don't have the time anymore. So these are how I'm being affected. So I need new ways of dealing with the literature. And I'm going to, and I think that represents an opportunity for publishers. So I will give you examples of how, you know, in our own little way, we're doing some of that, and how, of course, others are doing it. And so, you know, because these, as a researcher, I can tell you, these are the kind of tools that are going to be very valuable to me, or are very valuable to me. So what I have so far is I have aggregation. In my field, I have PubMed, and I have PubMed Central. Those are great aggregation services. But even there, I just don't have time to deal with all of those papers anymore. So even the related articles and all these other wonderful little gizmos that you can get from these aggregators is not enough. So just keep these things in mind. I'm giving you my experiences as a researcher in what's motivating me to think differently. I'm then going to give you my experiences of what I perceive of the publishing industry of by virtue of what's being changed. And then I'm going to try and bring the two together in probably what's going to be a some controversial way. But so if you think about how my laboratory operates, you know, I do computational biology, so perhaps in my case a little more is digital than would typically be the case in a wet laboratory. But notwithstanding, a lot of that wet data now is getting translated into digital form anyway. So a large part of a laboratory is driven by its electronic content. Now here's I don't know how many mail folders I have, but it's thousands and thousands and thousands, okay? I pigeonhole all of this stuff into these folders. The intellectual property of my whole laboratory is in those folders. And some mail tools are pretty good at handling it, but it has some serious consequences that I want to get over, okay? Basically, it creates this hub-and-spoke environment. So basically, I get an email from a student, I file it away, I respond to that student. It's a binary interaction. Others in the laboratory who may or may not be interested in that interaction don't get any access to that at all. It's buried in those folders. So I have this hub, I'm in this hub, and then there's a whole bunch of people, there's 25 people in my lab, who are basically, you know, on the periphery. And I really want to change that so that there's a greater level of communication between them. Now, there are tools for doing these kinds of things. You know, there is a tool for this, there's a tool for that, but there's not a tool for exactly what I want in my laboratory. So we use there are products for, say, project management, tools like Basecamp, which are actually very good for keeping these kinds of trails. There are, you know, various kinds of forums for maintaining email responses, but they don't necessarily deal well with other issues I have in the lab. So, regrettably, I generate way more negative data than I generate positive data. That is, the data that ultimately is drawn and comes into the paper that I ultimately publish about this stuff. You don't hear about negative data, okay? So, but that is changing itself. There are lots of projects now that are funded and driven by making negative data, with an obligation to make negative data available. And negative data has, you know, it can be extremely valuable. So I'll give you a sort of example from my own field. We basically spend a lot of time trying to make little crystals which ultimately lead to structures of proteins, okay? Making a crystal is not straightforward. robots do all of this now. There's hundreds of different things go into a mixture, and occasionally you get something. But if you actually have the negative data, the things that didn't work, and then you have the very few that work, and you put that together, you can learn much more. And in fact, you can use different types of expert systems to actually figure out what might actually work better. But that negative data has got to be out there. Now, you're not going to publish it, but it needs to be out there somewhere. And you know that kind of thing is just not happening enough yet. Also, any form of content management. Again, there are tools for doing content management, but they don't necessarily maintain the dialogue, okay? So this notion that we have slides, we have posters, we have data, we have lab notebooks, we have all the collaboration back and forth that went on, and we have journal clubs where we discuss other people's work. All of that produces content of which is not in any way easily maintainable in my laboratory. And yet ultimately, fractions of it form a publication that I get to in the end. We're big on open software as well, and open source. But, you know, where is it? If we produce something in the lab, the student leaves, and it's gone. I mean, I can never recover it myself because we didn't archive it necessarily in the proper way. We actually wrote a paper about this, and it's at the bottom there on the screen. And essentially, it's a woeful situation, is that we've tried to recover essentially very prestigious papers that ultimately had as a deliverable a piece of software. You know, even 1, 2, 3 years ago, and you say, okay, it says that software is available from the authors. You correspond with those authors, you never get it, okay? The ones that are up front tell you, okay, I can't put my hands on it anymore. Others will just say, well, we wanted to just to refine this a little, and then we're going to send it to you. It never comes, okay? So there's this whole spectrum of situations like this that is not doing us justice. And of course, when I say farewell to a student who goes on to do a postdoc or whatever it is they might do, essentially the data that they produced is for all purposes lost. So I'm being upfront here in the sense of telling you that the way that your average laboratory runs is less than adequate, okay? And you might say to yourself, what's this got to do with publishing, okay? Well, we'll come to that in a minute. So just to sort of build on, and I added this because it was sort of the kinds of things and questions that were asked this morning. Obviously, we're very driven by reward. And how we're measured to get that reward is obviously an important factor. And the question was raised, well, in terms of promotion, you know, how do people get measured? This was a question that was asked this morning. Is that decision of tenure changing? In my institution, the University of California, I can tell you that it basically goes in this order: grants, money. It's all about, you know, we maybe think we're in an ivory tower, but we're not in an ivory tower. The place is driven by money, okay? So grants actually, of course, there's a correlation between grants and papers because you don't produce good papers, you don't get grants. But really, ultimately, papers are actually come in second. And then a distant third and fourth, frankly, my opinion, is teaching and community service as to how we're measured. So, you know, I need to maintain those grants, I need to maintain those papers or the end product. So I'm actually looking to make my lab much more efficient so I can actually get bigger rewards, or my lab members can get, I don't care anymore, I have tenure, but you know, can get bigger rewards. So I'm driven to these kinds of changes. So that's enough about me. What about you? I mean, where do you fit into all of this? Well, let me just sort of say what I see some of the problems with the publishing industry right now. But first of all, that the data and the publications are disjoint. As you well know, that there's this. If you look at the supplemental information that appears in papers, it is just way out of control, as far as I'm concerned. That basically, it's actually growing very fast, and it's also effectively, for most purposes, unusable. So we talk about reproducibility, and it might be usable in some sense by a human, but I need, given the amount of stuff that's coming, I need that supplemental information to be usable by computer. This calls for standards and all sorts of other things that we currently don't have. And there is a lot more of it coming. I mean, we're in the biosciences, we're really at the tip of the iceberg with respect to data. You know, the $50 genome is really just around the corner. GWAS studies and everything else, all these kinds of massive data studies, are almost there, and those data sets are ultimately intimately tied with the publication. And yet, right now, they strike me as being very disparate things. So on the publishing, on the database side, there are there's 1,000 databases out there just in a fairly narrow area of biology. But they are in no way integrated with the paper itself. Sometimes they may not even be referenced together. Sometimes there's a vague reference, but there's not this intimate relationship between the two. And that's what I want. And I'll give you some examples of what you can do with it if you actually have it. Okay, so here's another sort of egregious statement. I can see you shuffling in your seats. And so please, push back at me at any time. Don't wait till the question thing. If you want to yell out now, please do it at any time. But I would argue that a paper is an artifact of a previous era. Whether it's a PDF, which is the current version of a paper, or whether it's something that is directly off the printing press. I don't think it's actually the logical endpoint of science, certainly not e-science. It's just something that over the years we've used as a summary point for how we state. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a succinct synopsis of a whole set of work that went on, but it's actually disembodied from the work that went on. So I'll keep coming back to this theme. So as a result of that, of course, whether it be page charges or whatever restrictions there are, even in an online-only journal, work is omitted. So that's the first problem with it. I mentioned already that the article and the supplement is somewhat of a mess, in my view. The visualization of that information is poorly given. So in some ways, a PDF is almost the worst medium to actually express the science that went on. Okay? I'll give you some examples of that. But in my field, I study proteins' functional relationships. Here's a three-dimensional picture of a protein, and here's written in the text somewhere in this paper is what it does. Well, those are totally disembodied from each other. I read in here that there's this important bond between these two atoms, and I can't even see it in a flat image. It's completely disembodied. I have to go and get the data, download it, learn how to use a program before I can even begin to interpret what the paper's telling me. So there's this disjuncture. The interaction and inquiry that I can make is actually essentially non-existent in a traditional PDF. There's no way that I can use, I go to databases and I can make some queries, but they generally don't have the knowledge that I'm after. What they have is basically the raw data. The knowledge is in the paper. I can interrogate the data, but I can't interrogate the knowledge in quite the same way. I need a completely different organization. And then rich media has a place to play in all of this. And, it's clearly something that's in wide use in the community of new scientists. And I'll tell you sort of how that came away. But I don't think we're using it very much, and we're not using it very effectively right now. So I'd say the traditional PDF, and please push back, is an inferior way to convey science. And it's not the natural end product of the research enterprise. So what I want is I want that natural end product. To do that, I think we need to have a completely different relationship between publishers, the customer, and the publisher. So, in a sense, we don't know, as scientists, we don't know much about you. We know because we have editorial boards, and they represent the journal, but they're scientists for the most part themselves, and depending on the journal structure, of course, it's not quite necessary like that. But it's not, scientists generally don't have dialogues about making better use of their scholarly output with the publisher. You're reaching out to us by virtue of this kind of forum, and I'm saying that we need to reach back to you. So essentially what happens is at some point, there's this disembodied production of a PDF that is the manuscript that gets thrown over this wall to the publisher, and hopefully at some point in the not too distant future, something comes back, hopefully with a positive outcome. But, you know, there could be much more engagement at different stages of the process. And we'll get to that in a bit. But I think, and we've heard a bit about it this morning already, the game is afoot. Change is actually actually happening quite a lot. And I think it's happening in the way that you're making it happen, and I would call that the top-down approach. But there's folks out there like me who are impatient. I can't wait. There's too much opportunity here. So there's a sort of groundswell of a bunch of scientists now who are trying to contribute and move this thing along. So that's what I would call the bottom up. So hopefully they'll meet in the middle, but who knows. But I'll give you some examples, particularly the bottom up sort of approach. So here's an example, in fact, of a bottom up approach. So this just sort of begins to illustrate, it doesn't mean anything by looking at it, and you're going to have to listen to what I'm saying, because it just doesn't really tell you the story. But it's a cue to tell me what to tell you. So basically, this is a view from the database, okay? And what it is, it's this protein database. It doesn't really matter what database it is. But what it's doing is it's pulling out of PubMed Central salient information about that, in this case, protein structure, in context into the database. Now, this has quite significant connotations because there's this relationship between this structure or this piece of data and a publication. Now, quite often, there'll be references to that data in a publication, but it's not cited. Therefore, even the original producer of the data has no idea that this data was discussed in a paper. Okay? But now we have, you know, at least full online access to some of the literature, we can actually start scanning that, looking for references to this data, and contextually, by virtue of how and where it appears in the paper, pull it into the database view. Okay? So it's actually bridging this disparate database versus publication and starting, it's one simple example of bringing those things together. I hope I'm being clear about this. Another aspect is that there's a lot of, we'll talk a bit more about semantic tagging, and I know that there are efforts going on in your community around that. The point I want to make with this, which is no way you could ever possibly read this, but I'm just going to tell you what's important. The most important thing of all is that suddenly semantic tagging is easy. It used to be very, very difficult. So what I'm doing now is I can actually put a tag on any piece of text that may relate, that then relates to data that happens to be somewhere else. Now, all I need to do in my HTML web page or whatever it is to semantically tag is add a very small and simple piece of JavaScript to that text. What that JavaScript does is, provided the data provider sets up a common API, I can just go out and get that information and bring it back. And that has enormous connotations and richness that it adds to the scientific publication. So in this case you can't read it, but it talks about a Nobel Prize winning study from Wendell Stanley, okay? Well, just by mousing over Wendell Stanley, I can now go out and pull a whole bunch of information about Wendell Stanley. Two major points, I made one already, it's easy. The second one is I don't leave the context of what I'm doing. It's not like I do a Google search and then I don't know what's authoritative and I go and read. This is something that's authoritative by virtue of the fact, let's say it was the publisher that did it or the author that then got peer reviewed and it was approved. So I have this richness that's been added which could actually very much enhance the whole learning experience. So that's one example. So these are just examples, both, that was a bottom, I'd say, because we're doing that, I'd say that was a bottom-up example of what can be done. This is a top-down one from Nature, and I think the idea is experimenting, and I think you're going to hear more about this tomorrow, perhaps, so I'm not going to say too much about it. But it's the idea that you can embed interactivity within the standard PDF framework. Now, my sense is that is not the way to go. It's actually a logical step because the PDF is the current unit of currency for online scholarly exchange. So it makes sense. But I worry, and I again love to be pushed back on this, is that it's not going to be simple enough, that the plugins that are required is not necessarily technologically the simplest way to go with this, even though it's quite well accepted. Yes, please. Well, this is against protocol, but please.
I'll take your challenge and please push back.
I'll try and repeat the question so we get it on the tape. You can see I'm very disruptive. I've ruined the whole flow of things. Get my coffee while you're
okay. Dave Martinson from the American Chemical Society. Actually, wanted to ask you a question about the previous slide, that the semantics is easy to do. And in my experience, a certain level of semantic tagging is easy. But to be comprehensive generally takes some human interaction. And I was wondering, in your estimation, how good is good enough? And do we need to be comprehensive?
I think you've raised a good question. I mean, in a sense, a lot of what I heard this morning had to do with authority. And a paper that comes from a certain journal has a notion of authority associated just by virtue of that journal. So if that journal itself has semantic tagging, then you would expect that same level of authority to apply. But it's not clear, to me at least, that ultimately that is what I want. So an example would be, I actually very much, this is again another outrageous statement, I actually like the idea that others post-publication could come in and semantically tag an article, which would then in a sense be not authoritative except by the fact that it was driven by crowdsourcing. So I'm not really answering your question because I don't really know the answer, but I like the idea of experimenting with these different types of options. We can come back to that if I didn't get that. Okay, so I mentioned a little about interactive PDFs. There's also another sort of related type of activity that's from the Optical Society of America in the journal Optics Express. And I'm just giving you a couple of examples. You may know about these already. But in this case, it's an example of actually a third-party plugin to a PDF that actually allows the data associated with that article to be analyzed and massaged by a specialized tool that's associated with this type of science. So that's just another example of these kinds of things. And there are many fields that have these kinds of tools for analyzing the data. So making this, it's another example of a sort of traditional journal data association, which would seem to me to be pretty important. So, and of course, I think you may hear some more too about the Article of the Future, and I won't belay this, but I think that was another example. I'm just giving you a few examples that are out there of these other kinds of innovations. So here's a case, and in a sense, this is the drop page, I guess, for this particular article. And essentially, it's organized that paper in a set of tabs. So you can, it's a navigation mechanism, okay? But that's just the beginning. So if I don't know if, how many of you have actually seen the YouTube video that shows the issue of Sports Illustrated on the iPad? A few of you. I would recommend, my personal view is I don't have shares in Apple. I don't know if the iPad is the tipping point, but I think it's illustrative of what's coming down the line. It is, I think, very eye-opening. So in that context, I can take an issue of Sports Illustrated or an issue of this paper from Cell, and I may choose to say, I don't want to read things in this particular order. I shuffle things around, and that's how that particular issue of the magazine is presented to me. Now, when I have limited time, I can see doing that with research articles as well. So it's basically I'm in control. I like that. I'm the one who's actually defining how I view the content. Okay, so that to me is an important thing. Another thing is embedded video. Embedded video is dead easy to use. This is taken from the article of the future. I'll give you some examples of where it's how we're using it in other ways, but it's actually a very telling thing. As you, some of you may know, there's now a journal, Jove, Journal of Visual Experiments. And the reason that's so compelling to me, at least, is because there's no amount of words and pictures that can necessarily describe some kinds of experiments. When I actually see the person doing them, and they're excited about what they're doing, and they're telling me about it as I do them, that's pretty compelling. So, you know, that in itself, in this context of Jove, is a publication. So why don't we have much more of that? And you'll probably tell me why, lots of reasons. But more semantic tagging, I'll come back to this in a second, and I think the writing is still out on the wall about a lot of the things that I'm telling you in terms of their value to the comprehension of science. All these are sort of early day experiments, I suppose. So, you know, you could ask yourself the question, how valuable is semantic tagging to, what I learn about the science that I'm trying to learn? And there's some data on this, but I don't think there's anywhere near enough. Here's again just another example from the same article of the Future series where, you know, you can basically navigate by figures, okay? Well, it turns out figures and figure captions tell you a lot about the contents of that paper, and it's actually a useful driver for how I might want to interpret that paper if I don't have the time to read a paper in its traditional form from beginning to end anymore. So then, let me just tell you a little... So that... Just talking about the rich media part of this, let me talk about the rich media, but not pre-publication. It'd be interesting, and perhaps we'll hear this tomorrow, and perhaps you know it already, but what is, you know, actually doing those kinds of innovations, whether it be semantic tagging, embedded video, and so forth, what's the relative cost that it produces to an article, and the difficulty of doing that? I mean, clearly there are barriers, okay? So all of this has to be taken into account. What I'm talking about here is actually post-publication integration of video and paper. And this is something we do in this company I founded called SciVe. So it's a conflict of interest, but certainly I'm making you aware of that. And one of the things I would show you, but this connection is a bit slow on this laptop. But basically, one of the things that we do is a pubcast where we integrate the full text of the paper, or it could be the abstract, but it works better with the full text, with a video associated with that paper, which is typically made by the author after the paper has been accepted or published. And you can see that by virtue of taking, in this case, something out of PubMed Central, we've actually arranged it here at the bottom. It's got the same kind of thing as you saw in Article of the Future, with figures in tabs. It also has a Web 2.0 connotation where you can comment on the work, you can actually rate the work and this kind of thing. And then it's broken the paper down into sections associated with the video. So here's just a different view of that. And essentially, the synchronization is done by the author or authors by taking the paper. They make a video describing their work, and then they synchronize it online very easily with the contents of the paper. So they could be talking about a particular set of data in a table. They can just drag across that table and then synchronize that to the timeline of the video. And so what happens when they're talking on the video about this fantastic piece of data they have, suddenly that data pops up in the table. So it's sort of like giving a talk, okay? So, and then on the other hand, perhaps a little more compelling, I could be just reading the paper. And I'm reading, what on earth is he or she saying about this? I just don't get it. And then you basically click on the paper, and up pops the author and starts telling you explicitly about that particular part of the paper. So it's kind of potentially an aid to learning, okay? So, but there are issues with all of this, okay? The issues are, you know, there's a potential energy barrier in doing this. Because once you've published the paper, you've kind of moved on. So why would I do it? Well, if you look at, if you take, say, a PLOS paper where there are article level metrics, you can follow those metrics over time, and then suddenly a podcast is made about that paper, and there's a huge jump. So basically, certainly these videos seem to be generating added interest in that paper, which over time we'll see whether that leads to citations. But that certainly attracts authors' attention if they're going to ultimately get more downloads and citations of their paper. But I think, you know, it kind of remains to be seen. So maybe, you know, and it's attractive, the business model here, there always has to be a business model. The business model in part has to do with the fact that it actually drives traffic to the publisher's website. So this 0.02% or whatever it was of people who actually purchase might actually go up if they've actually got this video teaser. So typically, you know, these things are 5 to 10 minutes. So these are just examples of, in this case, it's a mashup. It's actually mashing up traditional content with the video that the author's made afterwards. Turns out that that hasn't so far been dynamic. You know, that it's doing okay, but what always seems to happen in these kinds of businesses is the things that you never think of are the things that actually become the more successful. So if you look at how Flickr got started or PayPal, they didn't even start in the way that they operate now. They were doing something completely different. So what's worked better for us is the idea that you actually take things that are actually much more salient. So if you take a poster, you know, a scientist makes a poster. The student puts enormous amounts of time and energy into making this thing. It goes up at a meeting for 1 or 2 days at best, and that's the last you ever see of it. It might actually be on the wall in the lab, but no one ever sees it. So, and you don't always want this to happen because it's work in progress, but maybe you want that work to be more persistent. In which case, you know, you can make one of these poster casts where it's the same deal, okay? So instead of actually talking about the paper, you're talking about the poster. And as you talk about salient features of the poster, those parts of the poster actually pop up. Again, there's a business model here. We have a relationship with Thomson Reuters that's actually using these kinds of ideas in the context of Scholar One abstracts, and go into that. But so, you know, I acknowledge in all of this that if you introduce new things, they have to be persistent and they have to be paid for. So there have to be these kinds of models. Just to say a little more about semantic tagging before, you know, we go on to some other things. Here's just an example. One of the issues or one of the positive aspects of a lot of work in the life sciences is that there is very strict ontologies that are applied. Now, they don't necessarily appear in the paper. I mean, you can't force authors to actually use ontological terms. But, and we'll get to how you solve that problem, so you still have this problem of association. But if people are using ontological terms, you can gather them together. So in this case, we have ontological terms. These are actually very simple terms. But then you get immediately see on the side of the paper how many times and where in the paper that particular use of the term appeared. And so that's just an added kind of navigation tool that takes you quickly to the information that you might be interested in. That's the whole point. We have a resource called BioLit, which actually does this and keeps it up to date with PubMed Central on a weekly basis. Again, you can actually highlight figures. Might have a figure in the paper, and that goes and pulls other information from elsewhere associated with that figure. So I'll give you one scenario of what I want from you folks in a minute that sort of pulls these things together. So just bear with me. The idea of semantic tagging, I think, is powerful, but obviously it's best done by the author themselves. They're the content experts, rather than what we're doing currently, which is post-processing PubMed Central and trying to add these things. It's also more effective distribution of labor. And it also could add to what goes into the publishing process, so it could actually improve the quality of that paper. It actually potentially improve the peer review. These are a lot of big ifs, I agree. But so one of the things we've done in this regard, and this is, we're only one of a number of people doing this kind of thing, is we built a plugin for Word. And I'm sure it's very true in your fields, but in the PLOS, across the PLOS journals, I think probably 90 to 95% of the papers come in Word format, and the rest are probably in LaTeX. So essentially you're capturing a large part of the audience. And the way this works is essentially to add a column to the as the author is typing their paper. And essentially as they type a word, it's checking, as the spell checker checks, it checks everything that you're typing, not for correct spelling, but whether either it is an ontological term or it's a pseudonym for an ontological term. Or it's a database identifier, because that data associated with that term actually appears in a database. As you do that, it will tell you that, you know, you've used this term. You've used human, but you could use I'm giving a trivial example, homo sapien. And you get the choice. So the choices are that you could say, go away. It's like the paperclip. I don't want this thing. Get rid of it. Or you could say, I like it, but I don't want to use it. I just want to use my common term. But you can tag it. You can tag the ontological term to my paper so it becomes a piece of metadata. That is then a hook in my paper to a whole set of other resources that use the same common term, whether they be databases or other papers. So I can begin to build up semantic connections in this way. Or I can say, well, okay, I really like what you've told me. I'll use that in my paper. From a data point of view, I could actually be entering a gene, and I enter an identifier for the gene. It goes out to that database that's somewhere else in the world. It pulls up a salient summary of the information about that gene, and I can see if that's exactly the gene I was talking about. And I might actually now want to say something else about it. So we're talking about a sort of authoring tools that potentially, in the distant future, have the potential to improve the quality of the papers. This you can actually download. And you know, when I've talked about this before, people have said to me, well, no one has submitted a paper to our journal yet with this kind of markup. And that's true. And I think the big hurdle in all of this is, what's the reward in doing so? And you know, are publishers ready to support these kinds of initiatives? I think sooner or later, the groundswell from the authors will be hopefully great enough that it'll tend to push these things forward. At which point, there'll be some demand for doing this from the customer. An alternative, if you want to have a top-down approach, is you could say, okay, well, and this has actually worked in the International Union of Crystallography Journals, not for this purpose, but for the purpose of getting consistent data formats. They basically say, if you submit, well, they did it a number of years ago, if you submit the supporting data to this article in this particular format, we will fast-track your paper. There's nothing more. The second thing that people want, authors want, apart from being published, is to be published quickly. So that's quite a big incentive. Within, a very short period, 1 or 2 years, 95% of all data, supporting data that was required by these journals was submitted in the required format. So, you know, there are these carrots that can be put out there. Another sort of development that's coming, I think, is the idea, as I mentioned nearer the beginning, the idea of actually being able to short-circuit the process. I don't have time to read all of the papers. Notwithstanding, there's no way that I could ever read all the papers that relate to, let's say, a particular gene name. So what I want to do is I want automatic tools of discovery. Now the question for you is, well, whether you think I'm talking rubbish or whether if you believe these are probably good tools, whether in some way it's the publisher's responsibility or whether it's third parties or whatever else. But here's just an example of how it sort of works. Here, it doesn't matter what these are. Let's just say these are genes. Okay, each one of those nodes, each one of those squares in that network is a gene. Now, each edge, each line connecting them, indicates that they've appeared, those two gene names have appeared together in the same literature, in the same research article. You can't see it very well from here, but the thicker the line, the more they've appeared together. Now, interestingly, this was done automatically by scanning the literature, okay? And you really need the full text to do this. But basically what you see is that the network has a topology. And it turns out that this set of terms appears in the immunology literature. This set of terms appears primarily in the cardiac disease literature. And then there's this one gene in the middle that seems to appear in both. Now, it may be that that's because this has a shared function that affects both of these particular types of situations, immunology and cardiac disease. And it may be something that was undiscovered by the immunology community, in large part, may not realize that this has some impact on cardiac disease. So here's what I want in total, okay? This is my dream. This is why I'm here. This is what I want you to do for me, okay? I like the research article, don't get me wrong. I want that research article to be there. And that's what is there in the top left-hand corner here. Then when I read that article, there's a figure. It can be what we do now. It can actually be a little thumbnail. I click on that figure, I get this static thing. That's good. But what I want to do is I want to play with it, okay? I want to use a tool that's pertinent to the field that relates to this set of data that's represented in that figure. In this case, it's a structure. So what I want to do is I want to play with it. I want to move it around. I want to see things on it. I want to do that, basically, there has to be essentially the raw data about that figure and any metadata that was deposited with the article that generates an interactive version of that figure that I can now play with. I start interrogating that figure, and that figure itself has embedded annotation. I play with that. That actually then pulls up a composite set of information from different data sources and different literature sources about that particular thing that I was interested in, that figure. That then takes me to a new paper. And so I have a different kind of discovery mechanism than I previously had, that I could possibly get out of a static PDF. That's kind of what I'm looking for. And we're not actually that far from doing some of these things. So let's summarize where we are. How am I doing for time?
Perfect.
Oh, perfect. Well, I'm done yet, but okay. I haven't told you the good stuff yet. That was just the background. No. So I'm summarizing that as scientists, we have problems, okay? I have a problem, a big problem. You know, I have problems in my lab. You, as publishers, have problems changing business models, different demands, and changes afoot, both from the bottom and the top, is what I've been trying to tell you. Those are essentially what I've told you so far. So the question I have is, this is not my problem, it's not your problem, it's our problem. So what do we do about it? How do we solve these problems? So I sort of think about it in terms of what I do with workflows, okay? So what is my workflow? My workflow is I basically write a grant to do a piece of research. Now, eventually some work's done, and I do a poster before I publish to get some feedback. That comes a conference paper, a journal article, you're happy at this point. And so the circle continues. Right now, the responsible parties for those various types of information are quite different. So the feds give me the money sometimes. Societies, you know, this is not hard and fast, but you get the idea. Societies, you know, sponsor the conferences. You publish the articles. Already the system's being perturbed, okay? There's a lot of other stuff today coming into it that has some value which slowly is being realized. Obviously, good reviews have had value for a long time, but no one has really come up with a successful way of measuring that, so it makes a lot of difference to a scientist when they go up for tenure or career review or whatever else it is. We need to solve that problem. That's a big problem. There's a lot of people out there who put this data into these resources that I've been drawing on so heavily in this talk. They don't get much reward for that, the curators or whatever. There needs to be that kind of reward. Blogs. It's still very rare, but occasionally, as an editor-in-chief of a journal, I see a lot of reviews, and after a paper comes out, I will very occasionally see a blog posting about that article that was better than one of the reviews. My sense is that the review process is tottering on the edge right now. I mean, you can push back on this. We'll get to that in a second. And then community service and everything else. These are all things that feed into the academic workflow, which are not... So the reward system is a major issue here. And I, you know... So what I... And I haven't got solutions for any of that, but what I'm thinking and what I want is tomorrow's academic workflow, which is going to include all of these bits and pieces, okay? Let's just break it down a bit further. The research starts with an idea. It then, you know, generates, this is the wrong way around. You have a hypothesis to test based on that idea. You generate an experiment and some data to test that hypothesis. If all goes well, you start whizzing around this circle. Money's coming in, you're getting more papers, money's coming in, you know. Life is good. So what I want is I want you to take control of the whole process. This is where amazement, this is where you laugh. Some are laughing, good, okay. Some are amazed, some are asleep. But, you know. And I want to be able to control when I release parts of that information, okay? I want access control lists. So I can release, you know, parts of my initial ideas to the people I want to when I want to. I want to be more collaborative. I want tools to make me more collaborative. And I want all of this to happen seamlessly. So in the end, I want to solve my own problems that I have today in the lab. I want to solve your problems that, well, maybe you don't have any problems, but certainly. This is tittering laughter, come amazement, come fear. So what I'm after is we have an interaction with the publisher that does not begin when the scientific process ends, but begins at the beginning of the scientific process itself. That's what I want. It's not that easy, obviously. So here is a sort of, so what should we do? So right now we have this sort of spectrum of activity that starts with the scientist, the idea, the experiment, and so on. And then at the end it's thrown over the wall to the publisher. So that the big black line there is the wall. So maybe the line should be somewhere else, okay? Maybe it should be there. Maybe the responsibility is not all with you, it's not all with me. It's maybe the institutions have to play a role in the middle of this already. We had discussions this morning about the changing role of the libraries. Okay, so maybe the library has a very active role in all of this. And of course, it has to be made to work in the money that we have available. There's problems with all this. So in one sense, what I'm wanting to do is to publish this whole workflow. But, you know, there are a lot of issues with this, okay? Workflows are not linear, right? You start something, you go in a different direction, you come back. Mm-hmm. The workflow in the paper is not one-to-one. I mean, we bleed our workflows for as many papers as we can get. So, you know, there's those issues. Confidentiality, how do you keep the appropriate parts of whatever it is confidential to the right time? How do you peer review workflows as opposed to, you know, the things we have now? Clearly that needs a whole new set of tools and other things. Who has the infrastructure to do this? Will the community accept it? You know, what's the reward for doing all of this? Okay? So, you know, these are big barriers. What does it imply though? Well, maybe we'll have new organizations. Maybe what will happen is one scenario is that researchers in a university accept these kinds of notions slowly. The university starts self-publishing this stuff, and this is kind of happening now, but they do it in a more formal way. So instead of actually, you know, relying on all of you as publishers, different models can happen. You know, we're talking about appropriate reward systems. Reward systems are very slowly changing. It used to be, I sit on hundreds of these committees, and essentially it was always, we'd look at the CV, what have they published in what journals, okay? 2 years, maybe a bit more, people started looking in ISI, they started looking in other places, and they actually started looking at article level metrics. They actually started seeing, is this paper really what we believe it is in terms of its value. Okay, that was a very slight change. I've even got people now using tools like PubNet, which is, you know, a tool that actually shows levels of collaboration between investigators. So, you know, it basically goes and sucks out of PubMed all your, a certain person's name and everyone that they've ever published a paper with, and it builds a network. The topologies of those networks are very telling, you know. So if you're thinking of hiring a new faculty member or you're thinking of someone for promotion, how collaborative they are is something that now can be measured at some level. Probably not, it's not a good measure, but it's a measure. So people are thinking about this. And then to do anything like what I'm rambling on about is clearly a huge undertaking. So what I'm suggesting, this is where it gets even more outrageous, is that we need to crowdsource the electronic printing press. So essentially we need to reinvent the printing press to do things in the electronic era, but there's no one person or one small group of people who's going to do it for everyone, because it's just a massive undertaking. So we're actually... Yes, sorry, I'm finishing in 1 second. So the basic idea is to crowdsource the electronic printing press, and we're having a workshop on this. It's called Beyond the PDF. And the idea is actually to define some user requirements for what this would look like, have a commitment from at least one publisher to use the tools that we're going to develop as part of this process to produce, you know, something that's this research object of the future, whether it be a workflow or something else. And this will take place in San Diego sometime in the winter, probably, so good place to come for that. And then, you know, it's done, being done under the auspices of the W3C. These are a bunch of people who have already committed to being part of it, some of the names that you may either love or hate. And then, you know, if we had such a thing, what does it mean? And I'll leave you, I'll stop, because I'd sooner have the questions in the crowd. I'll leave you with these questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Am I okay on this? Thank you. We've got about 5 minutes for questions. We might overrun a little. Tony Derniak from IEEE.
Phil, fabulous presentation. Are you willing to pay for any of that?
No, I was hoping you would. No. Yeah, I mean, there's clearly... You're talking, which part are you talking about? The last piece here? This kind of tools to support these kind of workflows?
Yes, because the challenges you've thrown up there are fascinating. But what's the motivation for any of the groups, professional societies like IEEE, the commercial publishers, even the funding agencies, what's the motivation to put money into this if there's also at the same time this great clamor that everything should be free? And coming out of the IEEE environment, I understand the motivations of something like the open source software world, where people build an entire business on that open source software like Linux. So they have a motivation to keep the Linux alive. But I've been struggling for years to try to understand how to economically make this open access publishing model work. And I'd love to understand from your point of view, how should all of the innovations that you just talked about be paid for?
Well, I think it's a very good and question that could damn me completely and stop getting me invited to these things. But, you know, I think there were a lot of people who said that PLOS would not succeed when it started. And, you know, as I said, it took 7 years or whatever. And it's actually, I don't know how much of this I should say, it's probably public knowledge, but that in the end, what's happened is something that probably no one expected, is that PLOS One, which many of you know what that is, and I won't go, is essentially what's, you know, helping support the rest of the organization. The community journals, of which the one, including the one I do, are actually, you know, essentially breaking even. But the most prestigious of their journals, which have impact factors of 10 or thereabouts, in biology and medicine, they don't make any money on, in fact, they lose money on every paper. So, you know, I don't think anyone anticipated any of this when they really started, and the fact that PLOS One has been, at least in terms of, at some level, I think one would have to say has been successful. Again, that would be a big argument, but, you know, I think this was raised this morning. I think The challenge is to come up with new and novel ways as this unfolds to figure out business models that actually can work. And I guess what you're saying is you've yet to come upon one. But
we've got two or three more. We've got two or three more.
Okay, so I'm rambling. Okay. Rambling.
I can see Bill. But who are we going to take next, Barbara? Come in.
Okay. My name is Ove Kieler from Elsevier. Well, you asked valid questions to publishers whether we are ready for that. I would just ask you, are authors ready for that, to support this whole thing? I mean, making little film clips, doing all this extra work to enhance their content will also, of course, put a lot of additional work and pressure on them. I see you doing that, but what about your colleagues?
I think that's a very valid question. It's a question of ease, and it's a question... So just taking that as a specific example, what happened in the beginning, which I was surprised about, is the PI got involved, which actually, of course, is always the worst thing to happen. And it, because what they wanted was to have a video production that they believed was at the same quality of the paper that they produced. It became expensive, it became time-consuming, and in other words, big barriers. My original concept was that you would flip up your laptop, you would talk about this, you would upload it, and you'd synchronize, and you were done. And I think in a small way, people are starting to do that. Not so much with the papers, but certainly with the posters, because posters are perceived in a different way. So, yeah, there's definitely barriers, and I think, you know, the PIs, the old guys like me, are not going to do this stuff. But, you know, I was struck this morning by thinking that the people... You know, it's obvious, but the people, Facebook and all of these things did not exist. In fact, if someone told me I could make a video of a paper of mine and present it to the whole world when I was a graduate student, I would say that was just crazy, science fiction. You can do that easily now. So, I mean, I think the impact that Facebook, LinkedIn and all these other things are going to have on scientists who are now up and coming is going to be huge. I think what they require and what they're expecting is going to be very different.
Bill Park, Deep Dive.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. It was very, very thought-provoking. I was in hearing Tony's question about who would pay for it. I think the possible choices that occur is either the government through some sort of funding, because if it can provide more access to content to more users or more consumers, that would be worthwhile. But I think also a third party and an aggregator. And we've thought about this, not all of what you've described, but just conceptually what you've described, a deep dive, and particularly it was triggered by what's been going on with Archive and some of the funding.
You make it quick, Bill, because we...
So it's more of a comment than it is a question, which is, if the universities are trying to each create their own places to do this, I think you lose the power of crowdsourcing because the crowd gets fragmented and the tools of each of the fragments are different. I believe to make something like this happen requires a single aggregation point where you get the mass of users and the standardization of the interface so that users will begin embracing and interacting with the content.
I accept that. I mean, I think that PubMed is an example where aggregation at a single point has been very successful. I don't think there's any question about that. I'm not so sure as we move into a broader spectrum of data workflows that aggregation per se can continue to be at a single point. However, there needs to be standards around metadata that pull at least the metadata catalog together so I can actually go off and find that authoritative information. That is something that you're not going to get out of Google. You're going to need that kind of authority, and this is another talk and another project, but building those metadata catalogs seems to me to be another important aspect that needs to be done. Okay.
We're encroaching into tea, but I'd like to just carry on for a moment. Cave from...
Yeah, I agree with almost everything you say. I think that authors will take the time to tag. Authors already spend a lot of time to give the best presentation, the best paper. They're quite proud of what they do. And they're the best people to do any kind of semantic tagging. At the moment, they are the people doing semantic tag, or any kind of tagging, are people outsource companies like us. I'm Kaveh from River Valley, by the way. But we, instead of paying people like us to do it, authors should be doing it because they know what superscript A means. We are trying to guess what they're doing. So I support that.
Thanks, Kirby. Mark Brodsky.
I mean, I should say that, sorry, let me just make one slight, very quick comment, that the plugin to do semantic tagging by the author was actually sponsored by Microsoft, as they're doing with Royal Chemical Society and so on, because, you know, it's in their benefit. And, you know, these are, I think, good things.
This may be the last one, Mark.
I might suggest, I really like the direction you're going. It's the kind of way the world has to go. But this is very hard, this last slide. So I might suggest that you back up to where you began and encourage people to, before their postdocs leave and before the students leave, to do the kind of stuff you're saying, to make this record of the workflow and keep it yourselves. And if nothing else, you're going to learn how to create this kind of, for lack of a better word, documentation in the modern world of the laboratory books and the knowledge and the history of the laboratory. And if you can't do that, it's going to be very hard then to do the rest of it. So I would, it almost behooves each laboratory to take on that responsibility to keep their own archives, so to speak. Now, the problem there is there's very little reward other than you'll have your data and you'll be able to maybe save the next graduate student a year or so in startup knowledge.
I guess the reward comes if this actually in, God knows how many years from now actually worked, that in the end I would be able to effectively publish very quickly because everything would be in order. And at the end I would just press a button and essentially generate the publication from a subset of everything I've been keeping in order all along. That is the dream.
Phil, thank you very, very much indeed.